Welcome to the NGH Hypnosis Legacy Podcast, a special podcast series to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the National Guild of Hypnotists. Enjoy interviews, past and current, from pioneers in the hypnosis field, helping celebrate our past and pave our future.
Hello and welcome to the Hypnosis NGH podcast. I'm Jeremy Bashan, Executive Director of the National Guild of Hypnotists. This is our special edition 75th anniversary legacy podcast. Today's guest is founding NGH charter member, president of the National Guild of Hypnotists. The reason why we are all here today, Dr. Dwight Damon. Welcome, Dr. Damon.
Well, thank you, Jay.
So today I wanted to start off by, we're going to start at the very beginning. How did you become interested in hypnosis?
Well, as a growing up, as a youngster, I was interested in magic. And my parents encouraged that hobby I had. My mother had been in the entertainment business as an entertainment agent, and my father was also interested in the musical aspects of show business. So they encouraged my being a young magician, and since I was about 12, 13 years old, I certainly couldn't drive to do a show, so my mother got elected to drive me to the show, and also, since she was a musical teacher, she would do a musical background, and that way I didn't have to speak. I just did a silent act, and which irritated my father, because he was a talker. And he believed that an entertainer should get up and speak. And he used to quote, since they also had a theatrical agency, and he would point out other magicians who spoke. And he said, you should be like Tommy Tucker. And Tommy Tucker was a talker. So, you know, and he said, you get to be able to get up and speak. And I said, well, how about Silent Mora, who did a Chinese type of magic act and did not speak? And he said, well, that's an entirely different situation.
Okay.
So, but I was not an only child, but I might as well have been, because there was quite a gap between my age and my two brothers, and they were off fighting the war in Europe, World War II. They were both in the Merchant Marines, and they were officers on board ships. So I didn't really have too much growing up with them, since they weren't around. I just see them when they were back in port, waiting for another ship to load up to take supplies over to our troops.
Okay, so they were off to war while you were just a teenager. When you were in Cushing Academy?
I was more interested in show business than I was in learning French or mathematics, and particularly mathematics. I didn't like that at all. But we're spending more time with show business, and there was a man who had a big warehouse in Nashua, New Hampshire. And he took all sorts of things in and sold, bought and sold used stuff. And he had taken in a, what was called a medicine show, the Lithgow show.
Okay.
And so the man who owned the show had inherited it, I guess, had it stored. And I used to pester him a lot. He sold, bought and sold used items. And once I found out he had magic, I was a regular and bought every book he had. And then eventually he sort of took a liking to me and figured he would encourage my hobby of magic. And so he called and talked to my dad. And my dad says, well, we have to go down to Jigs Exchange on Sunday because your friend down there wants to see me. What have you done? And I said, I haven't done anything, you know. I said, he didn't tell you why he wanted to see us? He said, no, he said, just come down on Sunday. And he gave me a time. So we went down. Well, it appeared that he had bought a show, stored it away in the warehouse, forgotten all about it. And it was the Lithgow show, which was a traveling magic show. And it was all illusions. There were 14 trunkloads, trunks and crates. And he had his truck there. And he told my dad, he said, well, you'll have to help me load these crates and trunks into the truck. And he said, why am I now a truck loader? They were also Lodge brothers, and so there was a friendly exchange there. He said, because I want you to, I'm giving them to your son. And he said, well, what's in them? He said, magic illusions from the Lithgow magic show. And so my dad liked to listen to the ball game on Sunday afternoon. So we parked the car right near the warehouse door and cranked the radio up as loud as we could and started loading the truck. And I hadn't any previous knowledge. My dad was quite surprised. But they were also, as I say, they were also Lodge brothers in the Masonic order. And so he thought that was really a nice thing for him to do. So we loaded up his truck, brought them all up to our house. And so that was really when my hobby of small magic became large magic. And my parents encouraged it. They thought it was certainly a good hobby, good pastime. My mother had a theatrical background and had a studio where she taught dramatics and so forth. And so she became my chauffeur since I was underage.
And agent.
And my agent. And she had connections, still had connections in Boston. And so we were able to start right at, not at the very top in show business, but down close to it, because she took me in and introduced me to all the Boston theatrical agents. And this is my son, and he does a great magic act. And I back him up on the piano. So it's a musical, magical act.
So you were traveling all throughout New England as a youngster doing a magic show.
Yeah, I was 12 years old.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting to note. In the early years of hypnosis, a lot of the hypnotists had a background in magic. You were obviously traveling around, performing your show. When did you the first time of hypnosis come into your life?
I was living in Boston and going to Emerson College, and I was on my way to a meeting, and I saw a poster about free hypnotism show demonstration. And it was right on my way to this fraternity meeting I was going to. So I decided I would stop there, just see what was going on. And I went, and there was a strange-looking man with a goatee and mustache, long hair, and very, very hypnotic eyes. And he was giving a demonstration. And I don't think I'd ever really seen a hypnotism demonstration before.
And this mysterious gentleman was?
Dr. Rexwell North. And did a plug because he was also teaching hypnosis. And I thought, that's something I need to learn. So I had gotten the information about a class he was going to be running. And I called home and told my dad that there was a class I wanted to go to, but it cost extra money.
And $50 is a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. It was extracurricular. I mean, I was going to college.
Right.
And my father was paying tuition at Emerson College in Boston. So he wanted to know what it was about. And I said, well, it's to help me with, you know, my studies and so forth. He said, what is it for? I'm not going to give you the $50 unless you tell me what it's about. I said, actually, it's about hypnotism. He said, good, I'll send you the $50 tomorrow morning. And I thought, that's kind of strange.
I was going to say, did that shock you that he was like, oh, yeah.
It really surprised me. And I asked him later, how come, you know, there was no questions. He sent the money right away. And he said, because if you recall, I was always telling you, when you did your magic show, you had to learn to speak. So he sent me the $50, needless to say. And I signed up for the Rexford L. North course. Of course, Dr. Rexford L. North had then the good news and the bad news was he would accept me as a student, but he didn't have a class running right then. However, he would still accept the $50 tuition, and I would be a private student. I would get personal instruction. And I thought, well, that's even better.
Sure. And, so you became sort of an apprentice.
Yeah. But at the time, I really didn't understand that he actually was totally deaf. So my first visit, I contacted Dr. North. Told him that I would like to take the course, and he gave me a time and a day to show up, and he said, come to the Hotel Broadway, and I went there, and told me what room he had, and so I went to that room. The door was open, and he was sitting there at his typewriter, typing away, and I knocked on the open door. And he just kept typing, and I cleared my throat, and he still kept typing. And I thought, well, he's ignoring me. And then I stepped one step into the room, and I guess he felt the vibration. He was stone deaf. He couldn't hear me. That's why he didn't answer. And I thought, wow, what have I got myself in? You know. A man who can't hear me is going to teach me to be a hypnotist. Well, it turned out to be a very good start. And I built up quite a history with Rexford North. He taught me to be a hypnotist, became a good friend. Then I went to work for him. I was supposed to be attending college in Boston, Emerson College. The dean contacted my dad and said, there's something I need to talk to you about. Your son comes to school every day to college. He comes in, he goes through the social room. This is where students could gather, have coffee or soda and so forth before class. Hypnotizes all the young ladies in the room and performs a bit of a show. Then he goes to class. And he doesn't stay too long. I'm not sure where he goes from there. He said, so I'm going to check with him and see. My dad said, well, get back to me. So he got back to him. And he said, well, he said, I checked to see. He comes in, checks into school. Then he goes to the hypnotism center. And he and a local hypnotist do shows. He performs his magic, and the hypnotist and he do a whole show together. So he doesn't get much class time in at Emerson College. My father had found out what was going on. And he said, do you think you're getting more out of working at the hypnotism center and doing shows than you are going to college? I said, I don't really think I am, I know I am. Well, he said that I'm not going to waste my money paying tuition when I was in college. And he said, I'll give you the go-ahead. Your mother probably won't like it, but we'll try it out, see how that works out for you. And I said, okay, thank you, Dad. Now I had to figure out how I was going to live, because that did not include continuing to pay for a room.
Sure.
And I had a good setup on Beacon Street. I helped out at the rooming house. I helped the cook because I had experience in the kitchen. And so I didn't have to pay any room rent. I had a free room, very nice room on the ground floor. I just had to be handy for the afternoon meal to get ready for the evening. So that was my beginning with Rexville North, because that gave me the time to go over to the hypnotism center.
So right after you had stopped going to Emerson College, you jumped both feet right in.
Yep.
To the hypnosis center and working with Dr. North.
I learned firsthand how to be a hypnotist. My dad said I learned to talk on stage, and I was getting paid a token payment, not a lot of money. And that was my start in the world of hypnotism.
Excellent. So when you're at the Boston Hypnosis Center, did you and Dr. North see clients there as well, or is it mostly teaching?
Oh, no, he also saw clients. I wanted to learn how to hypnotize people. So he had arranged that when private clients came in, that he, I forget now what his excuse was for my being present, but anyway, I got to sit in on sessions, so I was learning firsthand how an expert dealt with hypnosis.
Sure.
And to make it even better, he had me do a magic act. He did the hypnosis. I did the driving, and he even paid me. I was really in, a good situation.
Well, getting paid to do something that you love to do at that age is amazing.
Yeah.
And you told me an interesting story before on when you went to perform with Dr. North. Because he was stone deaf, you had to actually help him get his tone. Is that correct? Of his voice?
Because we were playing mostly theaters. There were still movie houses that had live shows. We would go in the empty theater. North would go on stage. I would go up to the back of the house, and he would start talking. And he was stone deaf. He could hear nothing at all. And I would use hand signals and guide him as he spoke. No, you got to go louder. And I'm in the back of the theater. So he had to have good eyesight, and I had to have good hearing. And it made an imprint on him that when we opened to do the show that night, he was perfect without a mic. Although the theater's always provided a sound system, he never used it.
So once you got him to the right volume and pitch, that was locked in on him. So when he performed, it was without a hitch. You pretty much couldn't tell he was deaf.
It was without a hitch, except for the fact that because he could not hear his own voice, his voice was funny. It was sort of squeaky, and he looked different with a goatee and mustache, and very piercing eyes, and long hair. So he looked like he came from some other country. He looked like he was a magic or hypnotic type of person. And I learned a lot from him.
Do you think his look helped rapport with people? Maybe set expectations because he looked like a hypnotist?
Well, that was all. That's why I said he looked like a hypnotist, and the way he spoke, and... Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just looking at him, you knew that he was going to be able to hypnotize you.
Sure. So that already set client expectation. That must have helped tremendously in his hypnosis career.
It did, and he was a promoter. He'd been in show business a long time. And so he found a place for the Hypnotism Center, which was the first office of its type in Boston, and we had a large area for demonstrating hypnosis. We had two office spaces on that level. That was the start of my career.
Yeah. So after the Boston Hypnosis Center, and you established the National Guild of Hypnotists with your fellow colleagues and charter members, you actually moved to Iowa.
Well, first I was in the service.
Okay.
And when I was in the service, for example, if I was in New York City, I would contact all the big name hypnotists in New York City, get to know them, write a column about them in our journal. And that's when we started publishing the Journal of Hypnotism.
Wherever you were stationed, you got to meet other prominent hypnotists in that area.
Yeah. And it also helped me in other ways. Word got around, when the ship puts in the port here, they got a hypnotist on board. We can get them to come to the officers club and do a show. And the uniforms in those days were wool. And
very comfortable, right?
They were comfortable. But the pants, you know, the legs are rubbed together and the pants wear out, and, you know. And so I remember telling we pulled into one port, and they always came as soon as they heard our Spencer was coming in. The ship was a Spencer. They would come down and want to meet the hypnotist, Radioman, and get me to do a show. But I remember telling this one officer, I said, I can't. I said, look at this uniform. It's made out of wool. I said, the pants are all worn out on the insides where they rub together. I said, I can't do a show looking like a ragamuffin. He said, you don't have to. He said, I'll take care of that. Well, about a half hour later, a custom-made uniform, gabardine. I got so I had a flare on the bottom of the pants, so it was really classy. The inside of the uniform were the Chinese dragons and so forth.
So this is a dressy uniform.
But I was traveling on the subway with one of my pals, and there were a couple of seamen. They weren't Coast Guard, they were Navy, just regular Navy. And the guys looking at me and looking at the cuffs with my dragons on them. And one of them says, say, could you tell me, you know, how do you get those dragons? I said, duty in the China Sea. And he said, oh, you were in the China Sea? I said, oh, yeah. I said, I'm not Navy. I'm Coast Guard.
So you're part of the Dragon Company?
Yeah. Oh, it was really impressive.
Now, I recall you telling me a story about how you helped a fellow Coast Guard recruit pass a climbing test with hypnosis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when I was in boot camp, which was earlier, we had to pass a test. You had to climb hand over hand a 25-foot rope that went up to the top of the hangar. And if you never climbed a 25-foot rope, that's not easy. I had never climbed a 20-foot rope. I hadn't even climbed a 5-foot rope. And he was a medical officer. He was also an enthusiast as far as hypnotism. When he found out who I was, because I did a show, then I was out on the drill field with everybody else, and they said, Damon, report to the medical officers. You know, and I think, oh, this is not good. Somebody at home must be sick or something. And I went, and he was so enthused that he'd have another real professional hypnotist to talk to. He arranged to have me report there every afternoon instead of going out on the drill field and batting each other around. So I made a good friend there. And he wanted to know if I could hypnotize somebody to climb a 25-foot rope. I said, sure. So he arranged, had pictures taken of having a couple of recruits hypnotized, go up and down the rope. And he was all hepped up about, and also the PR person, a Coast Guard officer, they wanted to get something in a national publication. But the powers that be said, no, it'll make the Coast Guard look like some sort of a carnival.
Which is a shame, because at that time, you really helped these gentlemen, these recruits, who legitimately couldn't get up there. Maybe they were afraid of heights.
Yeah. But you know, the thing is, they took pictures, and it's a great picture of me standing at the bottom of this rope, holding my hands out as if I was casting a spell on a recruit that was halfway up the rope. It was slated to go into one of the major magazines. I was either Life or Time, one of those. And the headquarters of the Coast Guard.
Wouldn't let it go through.
So, no. It would have been a terrific break if we had gotten, because they got an okay from Life or Look, one of those magazines, and it was going to be a cover photo called The Indian Rope Trick.
And man, that would have been a great bump for Hypnosis back in the day.
Well, they didn't have any problem by doing shows on base. And one show I had, the base commander was one of my subjects, volunteered. And another officer came up during the show while I'm working with the skipper and told me to cut it. He didn't want the head of the Coast Guard base making a fool of himself.
Sure. All right. So you were in the service and you honed your skills while you were there, still hypnotizing people, still doing shows.
Well, our ships, I was on a weather ship. We put into Argentia, Newfoundland, for example. And as soon as the ship docked, there'd be somebody on board from the officers club to book me to come and do a show.
So that was your time in the Coast Guard. And you got a military grant to go to college. And at this time in your life, you had started a family.
Yep.
You were married. You had kids. And you needed to support your family. How did you come across becoming a chiropractor?
I guess I figured I can do that and still do other things at the same time.
Yep. So you moved the family to Davenport, Iowa.
Yep.
And you went to Palmer College and became a doctor in chiropractics.
That's right. And paid my way on the GI Bill and doing shows and teaching hypnosis.
And you never stopped doing magic either. You were continuing doing your magic shows and even a TV spot in Iowa, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's where I first started on television. So I look back at everything as part of my education.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when people, you know, say, well, I can't make a living, I just can't understand that.
I've learned from you, you know, that you have to be versatile. You have to be able to take on different things. With the NGH, though, things had kind of gotten dormant after you had become, you got your doctor of chiropractic and you moved back East Coast, but Dr. North at that time had disappeared.
That's right. We don't know where he went either. Yeah.
Just mysteriously disappeared into the blue. You just had kept in contact with a few people that were still involved in hypnosis, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Frank Anderson.
Yeah, about a half a dozen.
John Hughes. And this is an interesting part, too, is, and I didn't know this until my later years here, is our former convention coordinator, Elsa Meldridge Jr., grew up in Nashua, New Hampshire, and you were friendly with him, and his interest in magic is what connected you in the early years, but you reconnected in the 80s and brought the guild back to life with his help of the computer networking that he was doing.
I went to his office in Manchester and he was showing me around, and we went by one room where there was a young man sitting at a computer, and he said to him, he said, how are things in St. Louis today? And he looked at his computer. So we have so many signed up. And how about Los Angeles? Well, we have so many signed up for the 5 o'clock show. And I looked at him. I said, what's that all about? He said, well, I've got people all over the country working every day. And that's how I keep track. And I thought, I don't even own a computer. But I need one.
Yep.
So I did. I bought a computer, learned how to use it, and we were in business of spreading hypnosis.
Right, and reestablishing the guild and getting it back. It really is amazing that right now, as we speak, in 2025, that the NGH is 75 years old.
Almost as old as I am.
But, you know, over those years, would you have imagined that things would have grown to what they are today with having members in 105 different countries?
Not really.
It really is amazing.
Well, we've led the field.
In the early 80s, things have started to rebuild back together. You have some of the original charter members even came back into the fold that you hadn't seen for many years, such as your good friend Maurice Kershaw.
Yep.
And Professor Maurice Kershaw is also the chairman of the NGH board certification.
I consider him right there in the very beginning of the guild. I remember he came down from Canada, had a briefcase probably had everything he owned in it. And as I remember, he stayed at the Hypnotism Center for several days and nights, and we became very good friends.
Yep. And you said that you had run into him at one of your first conventions, I believe in Danvers, Massachusetts. He was down from Montreal, down in New England area for a different seminar. And he popped into the guild's first convention, and you put him to work right away. Is that a true story?
Yes. I said, take your jacket off and go report over there.
Start signing people in. Yep. Well, that's so neat, you know.
And he's still a member, loyal member.
He absolutely is. And You've made a lot of friends and a lot of great colleagues over the years. What would you want the future members to know about Dr. Damon and your legacy with the National Guild of Hypnotists?
Well, I never thought about that. I don't plan on going anywhere.
I can tell you right now that a lot of people will remember you as the father of modern hypnosis as we know it today. Hypnosis as a separate and distinct profession.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, and I think that one of the things that helped me was the fact that I had my education as a chiropractor. And chiropractic had to find its place in the world.
Right.
And so I was very well aware of that.
Well, I think you've done a wonderful job, Dr. Damon. And I really thank you for your time today, sharing with our members worldwide. We look forward to celebrating the 75th anniversary at our NGH convention. Please come and join us. Dr. Damon, I know you're looking forward to it, and we'll see you all there.
We'll see them all there, all right, Jay. We want to see a big crowd.